Find us on Facebook by searching Hollywood Hollow, and follow Alan on Twitter at AlanTwit, AllenTwit. Underrated of 2010 episode. It's an episode that I wanted to do for a long time now, and I figure it's 2011 and it's about due time. So essentially what this episode is going to be about, of course, is overrated, underrated, our most underrated films of 2010 and the most overrated films of 2010. And joining me today, me Alan, is James Van Fleet of the Asian Korean podcasts and various writers meeting podcasts, and Elizabeth Stanton.
What?
Who's become a serious regular.
I'm a serious regular. That means the opening credits.
Yes, you're going to the main titles right alongside me. Unfortunately, we had a fourth member of our team, but our fourth member has moved on, shall we say, and is no longer.
He's not dead. He just moved.
He has shuffled off this mortal coil. Also, hopefully the sound quality will be decent here. We're going to have a soundproof booth. And
hope you can hear the couch there. Oh. There we go. Now I'm comfy.
You know, I can almost hear that couch crinkling better than I can hear my own voice, or your voices.
No, that's not good.
Yeah, it's not good at all. So, overrated and underrated of 2010. There were a lot of interesting movies in 2010, you know, some good, some bad. It wasn't exactly a great year for films, but then again, you know, I think any year with films in it is a good year. I think that the last really great year, yes, that was a very deep comment on my part. Thank you, Jim, for acknowledging that. I think since 2007, I don't know, for some reason a lot of people seem to think that 2007 was a really great year for films, even though I think the only two really great films that came out that year or There Will Be Blood and No Country for Old Men. But
and Zodiac and The Mist.
Well,
I don't remember everything that came out that year.
And there were some other ones I can't remember off the top of my head, but I do remember just being, like, bountiful.
Really?
Strangely.
Well, I mean, Zodiac was
did In Bruges come out in 2007?
I think it did.
Because if it did, In Bruges was awesome, but that might have been a year or two later. I can't say with certainty.
In Bruges.
What else came out? A lot of good shit came out.
Was it the Dark Knight was 2008?
It was 2008.
I saw it alone when I moved here because I didn't have one.
You did, really?
I didn't want to be the last kid on the block to see the Dark Knight, so I went to the movie theater like late Sunday, the opening weekend.
Oh, really?
Yeah, that was good. It was fine seeing it by myself.
It's too bad that you didn't call me. I mean, the day
I've been
before,
here like 2 weeks.
That is no excuse, Elizabeth.
No, it's been scientifically proven that 2007 was an incredible year, as was 1999, as was 1994.
What happened in
99? In 99, there was like American Beauty, Magnolia, Fight Club, a number of others, Office Space, Requiem for a Dream. What's that?
Some of those are overrated.
Some of those are overrated, but
same.
If you're
not, but this isn't 1999.
Well, they're overrated if you're not smart about movies.
Ooh.
Whoa.
Ouch.
Okay. Whoa. The gloves come off. Damn.
Sensing some hostility here. Ouch.
Wow.
Well, I can tell you in Elizabeth's defense, I didn't like American Beauty all that much either.
That hasn't aged too well.
Right. When I first saw it, I remember liking it. But then I saw it again like 2 or 3 years ago, and I just thought it was really not good.
It seems very much of its time.
It's not even that. It suffers from the same problems that a lot of Alan Ball type of things also suffer from.
That plastic bag is so damn beautiful.
Huh?
That plastic bag is so damn beautiful.
It's his, he sort of tries to blend goofiness with extreme dark drama, and it just doesn't, like, a lot of the dialogue. I had the same issue with True Blood at first, in the first season, the first couple episodes.
It's weird I like True Blood, because I never got into 6 Feet Under, like, or I just haven't, you know, I tried to watch it a few times, and maybe it's just a matter of trying it again. But I never was very excited by that, or American Beauty, and yet I love True Blood.
I don't know too much about 6 Feet Under, but yeah, I don't know. American Beauty, to me, it was just, it, It was, you know how the first couple episodes of True Blood, they're kind of, I don't know, did you have any?
It's been a while since I've seen them, I mean.
They're just kind of, they're really over the top and
yeah,
kind of goofy.
For me
and,
anymore, it's weird because American Beauty seems like it thinks the things it's saying are very large and new.
Yeah.
And that's really not the case. And it wasn't even the case then because, like, that whole, like, you know, what's bubbling under the surface of suburbia was already being attacked by
yeah.
a lot of, like, I mean, people on not as big a scale with as big of actors, but, like, in Blue Velvet
yeah,
and, like, some of the, like, more... I'm trying to remember if,
mm-hmm.
like, well, I just brain farted. But anyway, that has nothing to do. None of this really. Sorry, this is my digression, and I apologize for it. American Beauty.
Well,
tangents.
I don't know. Well, anyway, the whole point is American Beauty is overrated because it's goofy and
we can all agree that American
kind of,
Beauty is
yes,
overrated.
Yes, good.
Put it on then.
All right, cool. Cool. And you also mentioned that it was a good year in 94. What happened in 94? Was it Pulp Fiction that
Pulp
year?
Pulp Fiction, Lion King, Shawshank Redemption, Ed Wood, Quiz Show, which is great.
I've never seen that either. Yeah.
Quiz Show is, I mean, like, I don't think it's amazing in its structure and all that stuff, but the performances are just, John Turturro is amazing in it, Ralph Fiennes is amazing in it, and it's kind of an interesting examination of, like, kind of, well, not an examination, it's an interesting backdrop, that whole time when, like, it was like, Geritol presents quiz, the quiz game, and, like, there was a lot of, and those were, that was back then, too, when the audiences weren't as fragmented, and a lot of people would tune in and watch a single show like that, you know, instead of having a whole bunch of different
specialized
channels and things like this.
So the film Quiz Show is about a quiz show? I take it that's the general...
It's about a scandal involving a quiz show where they were actually feeding them answers.
Oh, I think it's based on a true...
it's based on reality.
I remember hearing about that, yeah. Huh.
But it's just a really well-done film. And there are some other ones, too. I can't remember off the top of my head. But I remember I went through a very scientific process of getting drunk with a couple of film friends of mine, and we went over it. And, like, we're like, oh, man, 94 was amazing, man. Do we have any more moves? So.
That's the best way to come to any sort of conclusion, scientific or otherwise. Get drunk beforehand and then examine the data. And
then you can let your fists do the talking. You know?
You were about to earlier.
Well,
stone cold sober too.
I'm having a latte right now. So.
It's still early. The day still young, and
we still punch each other out.
All right. So going back to the previous year, 2010. So 2010 was an interesting year for films. There were some disappointments and some high points. It's a year of the. It was a year of The Social Network and of. True Grit. You still haven't seen the show, so
far.
You didn't tell me this, but if you had told me this before we started this episode,
started
I would have known. No way. I cannot have one of my guests not have watched one of the biggest
know,
movies.
I haven't seen Black Swan.
You haven't?
No.
I can tell you why I didn't
Nobody
see The Social Network. Because
okay.
I didn't have a whole hell of a lot of interest in seeing the movie in the first place, even after the reviews and stuff came out. But at first, I don't know what it is. I don't know if I'm not interested in the inner workings of Facebook or even those people, or I have a hard time sometimes watching unpleasant characters. I mean, that doesn't mean I'm incapable of doing it, but it just never sounded like a story that was really going to grab me and interest me the way other things this past year have. So I just have had no urge or page or push to see it, even after the reviews, award wins, and what have you. I'm just not that excited to see it.
So do you still feel like that now?
Yes.
So you're not planning on?
I will. I'm trying to maybe see it at some point. Somebody we know has a DVD of it. I think somebody's supposed to borrow it. My roommate's supposed to borrow it from somebody, and we're going to watch it. But the fact that he hasn't gotten around to it, and I never remember to remind him, not a big deal.
Well, I don't want to spoil the overrated aspect of my list, but I can tell you that The Social Network may make an appearance. So you're not too far off. Okay, cool. So I think that we should start with the underrated films of 2010 first. Let's do it this way. I'm going to ask Jim for, like, one of his underrated, then I'm going to ask you, then I'm going to go to me, and then so on and so forth until we're all done, and then we'll do the same thing for overrated.
Sure.
All right, cool. All right, Jim, are you ready for
sure.
your first? All right, so what's your first underrated film of 2010, in your opinion? Something that you saw that you thought was really good, or even just good, but that hasn't really gotten that much either acknowledgement or critical success or so on and so forth?
Well, there was, I saw the film Cyrus, and this is one made by the Duplass brothers and stars Jonah Hill and John C. Reilly and Marissa Tomei. And I don't think it's terribly underrated in any way. I think that most of the reviews kind of said that it was all right, it wasn't bad, it had some problems. I think that's all fair, but it was underrated in the sense that I thought that Jonah Hill gave a very good performance in it. And I thought that he interacted really well with John C. Reilly. And even though I didn't like the film's technique, which was not just handheld, but it seemed like almost this very stylized type of handheld with a lot of like smack zooms where it would just like they would immediately zoom in and then immediately zoom in and then kind of whip the camera around and stuff like that. That was distracting, but it wasn't terribly damaging to the film, and it didn't really hide the fact that I thought that those performances were very, very good. And also Marissa Tomei was good, but she's it's weird because even though she's kind of like the character between the two, she's not as much of a focal point of the story as much as the relationship between John C. Reilly and Jonah Hill. And so I thought that Jonah Hill had to play this very kind of, he had been mothered for his whole life and he was very much afraid of losing her. And so he has this weird kind of push-pull relationship with John C. Reilly, where John C. Reilly, he can tell that he's not a bad guy, but also this guy is kind of encroaching on this space between him and his mother. And so, it reminded me a bit of Adam Sandler in Punch Drunk Love, where it isn't necessarily that they're acting in a way that's terribly different from how they normally act, but it's been put in a different context and it works just as well. And I think that he was able to kind of, in doing so, he's able to kind of show that he can be pretty, he can be pretty earnest and sincere. And
how believable is it for someone that looks like Marissa Tomei to be dating someone like John C. Reilly in the film? Is that ever acknowledged? Like, oh, fat, not attractive.
I don't know. It depends on how attractive you find Marissa Tomei to be. I think that she's cute, but it's clear that she's also, I mean, like I believe the backstory in the film is that either her husband died or there was a very tumultuous split up between them. I can't remember with certainty, but it was something that very much kind of put her off, like looking for other men. And so, as long as it makes sense from a psychological standpoint, I don't think it really matters how attractive the person is. You know what I mean? I mean, as long as they can justify it by that person making the choice to not date often. Why she chooses John C. Reilly, I think, is just because she kind of, you know, senses a kindred spirit of some kind, because he's a very lonely guy as well. So
it's not all about looks, Alan.
Really? So you're saying that my whole life I've been...
It's not all about looks.
Okay. It's mostly about looks, what you're saying. Okay. I see what you're saying. Cool. All right. And you said that the movie itself wasn't that good, but you liked the performances in it?
Well, I mean, it's very much a character-driven story. And so since I liked those two performances and I thought they did a good job and made it compelling, I thought it was a good film. I didn't like how the Duplass brothers filmed things, but that's kind of my own inclination. And it seems like it's an inclination that a lot of movies nowadays don't care to not honor, but I mean, I just would like people to steady the camera and hold a cut for longer, just because I like that.
Well, some people consider that style. It's a certain kind of style, kind of like
but I feel like that should be default style.
The whole like the quick like, cuts.
No. I feel like people should default to holding. I mean, like, I feel like if there was a purpose to what they were doing, I couldn't see it.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Cool. Are you a fan of their other stuff, the Duplass brothers? Have you seen any of them?
I haven't seen their other works. Okay. They did, like, what, The Puffy Chair?
Yeah, they did The Puffy Chair. They did this movie called Baghead, which was kind of a horror comedy kind of thing. I think they did another movie, God Bless. I think they did another movie, but I don't remember. But I think if you didn't like the style in Cyrus, their style in their other movies is essentially the same thing. It's cheap handheld stuff, but it's how they're able to get away with doing such low budget films. Although with Cyrus, I think it might have been different because they actually had name actors in their films. In their film, I'm not sure how they I'm not sure what kind of budget they had or whatever. But
no, I can't imagine it was a big one. But I just feel like that was one that kind of got really lost in the shuffle in the summer. And even though it's not a great film, I think it's a good film. And I think that people who like are interested, people who like enjoy like Superbad and Get Into the Greek might be interested in checking that out and seeing like, oh, look at that.
Here's a movie.
Yeah, because I've never been, I hate Jonah Hill, but I can always take him in small doses.
Yeah.
When he's in the smaller parts and something like, what was he in? The 40-Year-Old Virgin and Knocked Up.
Was he in that?
Yeah, he was in both of those. He was briefly in 40-Year-Old Virgin. He was a guy who wanted to buy boots from that We Sell It For You.
Was him. Okay.
It was kind of funny.
I had forgotten about that.
But yeah, I didn't love Superbad the way other people seem to. I didn't find it that hilarious or engaging, though.
Huh.
The two leads didn't really do a lot for me, character-wise. I just wasn't that excited.
Michael Cera is not the greatest of actors, and how he continues to get work is beyond me, but I don't know. The film itself was funny. I'm sorry that you disagree, Elizabeth. Have you seen Cyrus?
I have not.
Okay. Well, I have another gem, so I can't agree or disagree with you, but I'll just assume that you're probably right.
I'm speaking from an honest place.
Mm-hmm.
That's all that matters, really. All right, Elizabeth, what about you? What's an underrated film of 2010 that you've...
I think Easy A was relatively underrated.
Good choice.
The flaws in it, the biggest flaw in it for me was it was trying too hard to shoehorn in 80s movie John Hughes stuff. You could have dropped all of that and it would have been it would have been even better, frankly. It didn't need that crutch of her saying, like, I wish my life was like an 80s John Hughes movie.
Which she actually says it in the film.
Something along those lines. Yeah, and that's why I was like, oh, but everything else around it is so funny and so smart. And she and Emma Stone, the lead actress, is just very good with time. Yeah, the timing of everything was very funny. And I thought the story, too, was really good. And it was intended to be an update of The Scarlet Letter. And I think it was very smart in the way it did everything. And how much the rumor mill affects girls in high school and stuff like that. Because she lies about having sex. She does not actually do it. Suddenly she's the slut and she'll do it with anybody. And just how it's... And she plays into it but doesn't love playing into it ultimately. And it spirals out of control and stuff. And I thought all that was very intelligent and very funny. And I think a lot of that got ignored in the movie too. Like, not in the movie itself, but people who saw it weren't that interested in that element of it. I thought that was one of the most important elements was...
Yeah, isn't that the whole point?
And I think it might have gotten more attention in some ways because it came, I think, before a lot of those stories came out about kids being bullied to death, basically, where a lot of kids felt have committed suicide recently. I mean, wow, this is really dark. I was like, ECA was funny. but it came out just before that.
Kids killing themselves.
And she's not bullied in the movie, but her friend is... And in a way, she is bullied, though, through the Amanda Bynes, like, Christian character and things like that. So I just thought it was a lot smarter and a lot more fun. And if they had just dropped the stupid 80s movie stuff, it would have been a really good movie. Or even better. It was a good movie to begin with. It didn't need a crutch.
I see what you're saying. Have you seen Easy A, Jim?
I have not.
I haven't either. It's too bad, but you can actually comment. I mean, I've heard a lot of good things about Easy A. I'm a fan of Emma Stone.
Mm-hmm.
I remember her from her TV days when she was on a short-lived Fox show called Drive with that guy from Firefly who plays the captain. The guy that you like.
Nathan Fillion?
That guy, Nathan Fillion. He was the lead in that movie. But she played, like, the daughter of this guy who played a pedophile in the film Happiness. Anyway, it's a good show, and I remember her in it, and then she was in Zombieland, too.
Yeah, she was funny in Zombieland.
What, was Zombieland from this year, by the way?
No, it was last year.
Okay.
Scratch that off the list, you're like, shoot.
Damn it. Another crappy movie I can't talk about, I'm just kidding. All right, cool, yeah, so yeah, it seems like a good film, but the concept seemed interesting, but the commercials sort of struck me about that film as it being kind of a traditional, like, predictable kind of cliche kind of thing. Is that, did you end up seeing that?
It's a little less predictable in some ways. I mean, it ends happily. You know, she gets the guy she wants.
Oh, what the?
Whoops, sorry.
Well, now I'm definitely
going to
watch.
Are we allowed to do spoilers for these or not?
Whatever, sure. Spoilers, guys. Spoilers for everything.
You say that a girl in a romantic comedy gets the guy at the end.
Well,
especially
I mean,
a teen romantic comedy.
It's like saying people die at the end of a scary movie or something.
What?
Well,
it happens.
Well, the thing is, I don't know who the romantic lead is. I mean, the romantic interest isn't an easy answer.
Well, I'll say what I liked about it in that regard was that wasn't a focus for her. Like, in so many romantic comedies and teen romantic comedies, it's all about getting the dream boyfriend and all that. And that isn't really on her radar when she's when she starts doing the lying, you know, about having sex with or doing sexual favors with the nerdier guys, and the boyfriend isn't like the perfect like dream jock. He's sort of equally in a way nerdy like she is.
Really?
You know, she's not nerdy in the sense that like I don't know, she's like ostracized or anything like that, but she's just in the middle of the pack, not like derided or not like super popular, but just like where any of us might be in that social ladder. You're just somewhere in the middle cruising along, minding your own business, and then, you know, oh, this stuff happens.
Mm-hmm.
But like I said, it's not like getting a boyfriend is not a focus for her. And I think there are some really funny scenes in the movie that kind of illustrate that. Like her best friend's like, I'm going to go out this weekend. Do I go? She's like, oh no, I'm going to go do this, that, or the other thing, and all they do, and they cut to her just hanging around her room the entire weekend, and she gets, like, a birthday card or something that's, like, has $5 in it for her grandma, and it plays that, I Got a Pocket Full of Sunshine song, where it's like, I got a pocket full of sunshine, and then, like, she's like, oh, it's the worst song ever, and then over the weekend, she keeps opening the card and playing with it, and by, like, the end of that chunk of scenes, it's her ringtone on her phone, so every time her phone rings the rest of the movie and starts playing, I got a pocket, I got a pocket. So, and it's just a really funny thing. And then the first guy she does the line about the sexual favor for, he gives her a gift, and her mom's like, your boyfriend, haha, brought this over. And she goes, well, put it on my pile of gifts from my other suitors. And there's like nothing, or, you know, there's nothing around, it's just the one box. It's very funny. So I like that. It's not traditional in that sense that, like, getting a man is not her primary goal, as it is in so many other romantic comedies. Like, I have an awesome life and stuff, but it's incomplete because I don't have a man, you know?
Yeah.
It's a little old.
The Farmer, well, I think that it's the same thing. It's the same thing with, like, guy movies involving romance.
Right.
Like, usually guys are expected to have some kind of romantic interest. And
it's usually, weirdly, the girl you liked from elementary school.
Yeah,
like,
or
really?
It's the popular, attractive girl. It's somehow she's the type of girl that you wouldn't. She's like so out of his league that it's almost impossible for them to get together at the end. And yet that seems to always happen. It's this big illusion.
True heart or something.
Yeah. He's really sensitive deep down inside. That's enough to convert her to well, I don't know, whatever stupid thing. Anyway, I actually like that. I like the concept of EZE. I also like the fact that they cast Emma Stone in the role, because she's not quite like, she's believable in the sense that she can be nerdy. She's not exactly the most attractive girl that they could. She's not someone like an Emma Roberts or like a Hayden
Panettiere,
that girl from Heroes, where. Really? You think she's weird? I think she's gorgeous.
She's got this nice looking Tippi Hedren getup for the Scream 4.
Yeah, with the show. Well, that's probably because she dies in it. I imagine.
Well, yeah, probably.
Most likely.
But,
no, I was gonna say, like, you would never call Emma Stone ugly.
She's not ugly, but
like,
she's not traditionally attractive. She's attractive, but she's not beautiful in the Hollywood female sense. Like her. She has like kind of like her eyes are kind of buggy and she looks kind of but she's still attractive and her voice is very sexy, so that's always a good thing. But no, but it's more realistic to have someone that looks like her. You can see why she would be pining for someone, and unlike someone like Emma Roberts or that girl from Heroes, where a lot of the time Hollywood will cast women that look like her as the nerdy geeks, and it's just unrealistic. Like, there's no way that a girl that good looking could have that much trouble getting men, you know, or getting male interest, and they would not be nerdy. I'm trying to think. There was an interview that I read recently with like some extremely attractive woman who, some actress who was like, "Oh yeah, I was a total nerd when I was younger," or something like that. And I just laughed and stopped.
Well, Natalie Portman's always gone about how nerdy she is. I think that she revealed that though when she did her goofy laugh.
Yeah.
I think that the facade was cracked.
She seems like the nerdy type. Like, I think that she's attractive, but I don't know. She's not.
I always was like, oh, she always says she's so, like, nerdy, or blah. I'm like, eh, no, she's not. And she's like, he totally would have sex with me. I was like, okay, maybe you are a nerd. All right. Forgive you, finally. But, yeah.
That was funny.
That was pretty funny when that happened.
Well, whatever. That's her. So, anyway, Easy A. Haven't seen that movie. So, Cyrus and Easy A. Right, Myla. Mine on the list, and this might shock some people, but have you guys seen the movie Wall Street 2?
No.
See, look at that shock from Jim. He was genuinely shocked.
I'm shocked.
I haven't seen
the original, so I thought let's not put the cart before the horse.
That's exactly how it actually, and I never got around to doing it either.
The sequel is almost exactly the same thing as the original. If you like the original, although a lot of people didn't like this movie when it came out, Wall Street 2. I don't really know why. Like, it's essentially like the first one, except it stars Shia LaBeouf instead of Charlie Sheen.
That's probably part of the hesitation. And then I think people were... There's a certain amount of sequelitis, so to speak.
Well,
with people being like, a sequel to this 25 years after the fact? Like... Was Shia LaBeouf even, like, born when the movie came out? Yeah,
I don't think so.
I don't know if I was. I don't remember when it came out.
I think it came out in the 80s. It came out, like, 88, I think.
Oh, okay. I was two.
Sure.
I mean, I saw Wall Street at the tender age of two.
Well, because it's not... It's a movie that didn't need a sequel, essentially, but...
I think that was why some people didn't want to warm up to it.
But that's not saying that the sequel that we did get was bad. I really enjoyed it. I thought that it made about as much sense as the first one did, in the sense that it didn't for me. Like, unless you're into Wall Street and economics and you understand the language, it doesn't really make sense. But Oliver Stone is such a good director. He just does things with the pacing and the editing and the acting that it feels like you're watching an action film, even though all that's happening is people are just discussing and trading stocks. And And I actually, what I really liked about Wall Street 2, aside from the performances, was it had a lot. Are you guys familiar with Oliver Stone's work? Have you guys seen Oliver Stone's movies?
I'm trying to remember. What has he done?
What hasn't he
Unfortunately,
done?
Unfortunately, the only thing that keeps leading to mine is Alexander. That's the only thing I've seen of his recently.
With Alexander, he did Any Given Sunday, which I haven't seen. He did
JFK.
JFK, which I haven't seen.
It's one of the best movies I've ever seen. You should watch JFK. It's really good. He did Nixon. He did Born on the 4th of July with Tom Cruise.
Yes. He did Platoon too.
He did Platoon, yep.
I
thought
Born on the 4th of July was amazing.
Yeah, it's a great movie.
I thought Platoon was very good.
Yeah.
And there may be another one.
Natural Born Killers.
I feel bad because the only thing I've seen is Alexander, and that's terrible.
Man. Yeah, Alexander was not one of his best movies. He did a...
Okay, Angelina Jolie. All right.
World Trade Center, he did that movie, which I thought was his poorest movie.
I didn't want to see that.
I didn't like it. The first hour of World Trade Center was pretty good, but then it just goes downhill, unfortunately. But it's still pretty good. He comes out with movies every couple years. He's one of my favorite directors, actually.
I was curious to see W.
W, he did W, that was really good.
I wanted to see W.
I liked that movie. It was good. He's done all these movies that you guys haven't seen.
I feel like I'm very, very behind in my Oliver Stone canon.
There are too many movies, dude. I can't help it.
He's one of the best filmmakers currently still up. I actually got a chance to see a Q&A with him a few months ago at the screening of this. He did a documentary on Chavez in Cuba, the president of Cuba, and he did a Q&A afterward, and I saw him in real life, and I'm sorry to report that I think he's going deaf, unfortunately, which is sad, but he's still a great filmmaker. Anyway, so Wall Street 2. Yeah, it was great. If you're familiar with
it. Technically, it's Wall Street Money Never Sleeps.
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah.
There's no union.
It's true. That's true. You're right.
It's the Hollywood way.
I'm sorry.
Trying to hide the fact that they're making nothing but sequels.
To see. Well, if you were familiar with.
It's a reimagining, or else, you know, they just subtitle it. Like they did with the Pirates movies.
The Transformers. Yeah. Well, if you guys were familiar with Oliver Stone movies, you'd know that a lot of his movies have this apocalyptic undertone to them. Sometimes they have this thing where there's this big conspiracy, this giant hand that's controlling everything, and that at any moment could pull the rug from under us and destroy everything. At least that's the impression that I get from a lot of his movies. And I was surprised that it's present in Wall Street 2. There's this one scene where essentially Wall Street 2 is about the collapse of the economy in 2007-2008, and there's this one scene in the film where Josh Brolin's character, who's this big an industrial type, he's a billionaire, and he's talking to these other billionaires in this closed off room where the stocks have just collapsed, and they're talking about how if the government doesn't start pumping on the economy will collapse and the whole world will end. And it just has this really, like, this darkness to it, this apocalyptic darkness to it. And all they're doing is talking about money. It's just a bunch of guys in business suits sitting around a table talking about money. And Josh Brolin has this line where he's like, the ball is over, folks. Or something. Like, if we don't get some kind of assistance, the ball is over, ladies. We all go home, or something like that. Like his delivery of that line was just so. It summarized the entire film for me, in my opinion. Where this is what happens when you give so much power and so much money to a small handful of people. You know, these things happen. I just love that whole aspect of it, where it turned a movie that's essentially about a father trying to connect with his daughter into this big economic apocalyptic thing. And there's also other aspects to it that were good too. It's a very tightly edited movie. Shia LaBeouf isn't bad at it. I actually like Shia LaBeouf as an actor.
I don't think he's as bad as people complain about. I think, because actually the movie, one of the movies that he was in that I thought he was really good was Holes.
I've heard of that.
It's very good. It's a good movie, good story, and he carries it well. And there's something else I saw him in where I was like,
yeah, he's not a bad actor.
I think he just gets a bad rap.
I mean, there is a reason why he's been propelled to fame from, like, a few years ago. No one knew who he was, and then all of a sudden
it's because of Steven Spielberg.
Yeah, that's
why.
He's working with Spielberg.
No, I'm saying Spielberg pushed him.
Right, exactly. But there's a reason why Spielberg pushed him, because Spielberg has good taste in actors and in filmmaking. He's a master filmmaker, and he saw talent in him, and, you know, he wasn't wrong. Shia LaBeouf is a good actor. I just think, I don't know, there's something about him that turns people off, I guess, but...
It's not that... Maybe what turns people, like, for example, me, about him is that he's not necessarily a bad actor, but he always seems to be in movies that I feel don't need him. He's in those Transformers movies,
right,
and they don't need him. He's in an Indiana Jones movie, and they don't need him. And then, you know, I see ads for Wall Street, Money Never Sleeps, and you see him as, like, the focal point in a movie that's about the financial collapse and Gordon Gekko and Josh Brolin types. And I'm thinking, why does this need him? And I keep struggling to come up with reasons for why movies need Shia LaBeouf. And the only thing I can figure is that he's one of the most inoffensive names that will get younger people interested. It's not necessarily, and that's not to say I think he's untalented, because I didn't think he did a bad job in the Indiana Jones movie. I didn't think that he was a problem. There were problems in that film. I didn't think he was a big one.
He was a non-issue with that movie.
There are bigger things at work in that. But then, like, even in the Transformers movies, what is he in the movies? He is a device around which they can center their story. He's not an interesting character. Well, the MacGuffin is like the Allspark or whatever that thing is.
I only saw the first one.
Well, the second one is the same thing, because instead of the Allspark, it's a piece of the Allspark.
Oh, okay.
And then there's like some nonsense about
You know what blew my mind when I saw the first one was John Turturro was in it. And
John Turturro's in the second
one. I couldn't stop like kind of just laughing and like losing it in the theater. I was like, why is he in this? Oh, my God. Whatever, you know, choices, what have you. I don't care. But I was like, it pulled it. Him being in the movie made it bearable for me. Like, that was, I was like, I can sit through the rest of this movie knowing he's in it. Okay.
I would like to see Shia LaBeouf do something small and one that accentuates his comedy, because I do think he can be funny, because he's done good work on SNL.
Yes.
He's hosted. Kind of got started doing comedy with like the Disney shows he was in, like Even Stevens. So if he did something more like that, I might be more interested. But I just keep seeing him in these big movies, and I keep thinking, but why? But why?
I think it feels as though they're trying to breed him into the next DiCaprio.
DiCaprio. Tom Hanks is technically who Spielberg compared him most. Yeah,
he did.
Yeah.
Hmm.
That's who Spielberg compared him to. I'm not saying that I agree with the comparison.
You're saying that Steven Spielberg is wrong, is what you're saying.
Steven Spielberg is screwed up a lot of times.
He
made Hook.
Aw,
that was in the 90s.
It's not a good movie.
Really? So would that be overrated or underrated? I think it would be.
I don't know. Most
Hook
people have
Wall
forgotten
Street.
About Hook.
I don't know.
People who bought it for $5 a card.
I like the sound of that. I like certain scenes from Hook.
But
I still remember
I just hope that Shia LaBeouf explanation makes sense.
No, it does.
I
see what you're saying. I guess. I don't know. I mean, how do you justify it? You know.
I mean, if we want to get into an argument of how do I justify Transformers in any capacity,
right?
Then we run into problems.
That's impossible. There's no way. Well, in Wall Street 2, although he might not have been necessary in the film, didn't bother me. I mean, it's not Michael Douglas's movie like the first Wall Street was, but it's something more. It tells a more interesting story, in my opinion, than the first did. So, but this is my opinion, and I haven't seen the first movie in many, many years. So it's possible that maybe someday I'll watch the first movie again. I'll be like, oh, compared to the first, the second one was a piece of crap. So who knows? But as of now, I say that Wall Street 2 is underrated. 2010. I liked it. So there. All right, Jim. What's the next one on your list? Actually, wait. Should we go overrated, underrated, overrated, underrated?
I like alternating. It's fine.
Okay, let's alternate then. Let's do one overrated for you. Overrated of 2010.
Oh, gosh. There were a good amount. Let's see if I can pick one. I will be going around a few times, so I'll say that Kick-Ass, even though it wasn't highly rated, was completely overrated. It was crappy. It completely forgot what it was. It decided to be something else. There were one or two good performances, but the main performance was not interesting at all. I just think that it's a movie that thinks it's smart and then just completely surrenders to the dumb, and I didn't like it at all. I was just so disappointed with it.
Well, Jim, I could not agree with you more.
Really?
I never thought I'd say that, but I completely agree with you. I thought it was one of the worst movies of the year that I've seen.
Yeah,
and,
no, it was one of the worst movies of the year, I thought as well.
It didn't even have a plot, and the little plot that it did have was ridiculous.
I mean, the story is ostensibly about this kid who wants to become a superhero, and so like the first maybe 20 minutes or so of the movie are about him trying to become like a superhero. And there's something interesting to that a little bit, because he's doing it despite not having any skill, not having a good plan, not having a good costume. All he knows is that he wants to be a superhero, and so he just puts on this like swim gear and goes out and patrols. And it's interesting because he's becoming a superhero through sheer force of will. He gets beaten up and he keeps going. He gets landed in the hospital and he keeps going. And so I thought that was interesting, because I felt like that was at least a somewhat plausible way of approaching a real world superhero, as one who just doesn't care that he's constantly getting the shit knocked out of him. So I thought that was interesting. But then he gets involved in this whole like very traditional action movie kind of revenge story in which that Big Daddy character, played by Nicolas Cage, wants to get back at this gangster who I think was involved with some sort of tragedy. And it's like, I can't remember for sure. Was it the death of his wife or something?
Yeah, I think so.
He's training the girl, right?
Yeah, because he's got the little girl. So it's something like that. I can't remember with certainty, but it's a tragedy that kind of makes him decide to go up against this gangster. And so then Kick-Ass, that character, gets pulled into this plot. And this plot is just the most boring, unsurprising, traditional thing in the world. And Hit Girl completely hurts the movie because she is just completely impossible as a character. She shouldn't be able to do the things that she is capable of doing. This movie, like, at some point jumps the tracks and stops becoming this cool little, like, anti whatever look at comic book superheroes in a real setting, and just totally succumbs to the crappy fantasy aspects that are not interesting anymore. They aren't interesting anymore.
That's why I didn't even want to see it, because I'm so burned out on comic book movies.
It's just
to the nth degree.
And so, it was just so frustrating. And then, you know, I heard of somebody, oh, it's so cool. Oh, man, you won't believe it. Oh, it's so awesome. And Hit Girl totally kills all these guys in the hallway. And there's a part, too, where Hit Girl kills an innocent woman.
Really?
Yeah.
All right.
I mean, this woman is, like, hanging out with gangsters or something like that, but she has done nothing to earn death.
Or the kind of death that she gets.
Which is just
brutal.
This awful, stupid posturing kind of stuff that Hit Girl does. I mean, like, again, the film, like, starts out being satire, but then it just completely surrenders to, like, trying to create its own iconography and cast of, like, superheroes and supervillains. And the more I talk about it, it's like a feedback loop. Now I just think that it's one of the worst movies I've ever seen. Yeah, I mean, it's not, but I mean, it feels that way right now just because it's so angering. I mean, most of all, because at the beginning you get the feeling it might be an interesting thing. And it's not.
Are you familiar with the comic books at all?
No,
or even if they're based on comic books?
I mean, I know that they're from Mark Miller, and he's done some comic books that have gotten attention. I don't know how much acclaim they've gotten, but they've gotten a lot of attention.
Oh, okay.
He has this one called Nemesis.
I heard of that.
Yeah.
I was just going to ask, if you were familiar with the comic books, how faithfully does the movie follow the comic books? And does it follow the same kind of flawed?
I mean, my understanding that it's relatively close to the comic book.
Okay.
That's my understanding. I did like Nicolas Cage doing his Adam West voice. That was
I like
cute.
That scene. I agree with you, Jim, except I think that you weren't being harsh enough. I didn't like the movie initially. Even the whole plot with the whole guy trying to be a superhero. People were saying when this movie first came out that, oh, it's such an original concept, blah, blah, blah. No, it's not an original concept. We've been seeing this kind of thing for the last 10 years. It's not a comic book movies. A loser trying to become a comic book, a loser trying to become a superhero is not a new concept. It is not an original concept.
I feel like a loser who becomes a superhero isn't a new concept, but I feel like a loser in a relatively real world circumstance who doesn't have any actual powers trying to become a superhero is a little bit more off the beaten path.
It's not this great, like, amazing original concept, though.
No,
it's just kind of. The only original aspect to it was the level of violence and the little girl's involvement. But even that's not really creative in any kind of way. It's just kind of, it's cheap and sleazy, and that's how the movie felt to me. But before I watched the movie, I had heard that there was a great deal of backlash because Roger Ebert complained in his review of the film that the fact that the movie had the little girl killing all these people was exploitation. And a lot of people got on his back about that. They were angry at him about that, thinking, mm-hmm. Oh, it's just a movie. And that's how I felt too about it when I first read that complaint. But then I watched the movie, and then afterward, I cannot but agree with him that it just felt wrong to have this little girl who was like 11 or 12 years old going around and killing these people in such horrible, brutal ways. It just felt like after a while, it felt like they were taking advantage of it
It's transgression for the sake of transgression. It doesn't actually say anything or have anything meaningful to offer, or at least tweak that in any useful way. I mean, like, and it's like I was saying earlier, by the end, she's a comic book hero jumping around like she's right out of a John Woo film.
It's shock for the sake of shock by having her kill the people and say. And I remember the other big thing besides killing was saying all the things.
It feels like the movie's saying at you, "Wow, isn't this so daring? Isn't this? I mean, like
this tiny girl doing this.
You probably can't handle it, can you?" And I just feel like, well, you know what? I don't want to handle it if it's just
That's all you're gonna do, movie.
Well, yeah. If that's all you got, then no, I'm not gonna engage with that. And you know. God bless you for trying to push the bar for no good reason whatsoever, but...
So now, child violence is now acceptable thanks to this movie. This movie tried to bring the concept of child violence into the mainstream as being acceptable. That's a big contribution to society.
Someone I talked to tried to compare it to movies like Shoot 'Em Up or Crank, where it's very heightened, but it doesn't begin heightened, and those films really commit to how cartoony and preposterous they are. I mean, from the word go, and they're kind of, those ones are based a little bit more almost on comedy than on this one, which thinks it's being cool. But isn't.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, I mean,
it's also just a bad movie. Like, yeah, the plot wasn't even that good, and like the
plot's not that good. Yeah. Well, I mean, the plot is actually doesn't even like work in any terribly interesting way, because the only reason that there is a plot is because Nicolas Cage wants to kill the gangster. The gangster throughout the whole movie is really just defending himself.
Is Kick-Ass the same movie with that guy from Superbad, Nick Levin? It had that whole ridiculous thing where he befriends the main character, and then at the end is this the same movie?
Yeah.
Oh my god, I hated that whole plot. That was one of the worst.
I think that you can't even remember that it was part of the
because
movie.
Because it was such a bad, ridiculous thing that I tried to block it out of my brain. It's just so bad, though. And then at the end, he takes his father's place, and it's just...
Yeah,
you know what? I've tried to drown that whole movie out. The only scene that I liked that I thought was somewhat creative was the scene where, this is a huge spoiler, but Nicolas Cage is tied up, shall we say, and he's yelling things at his daughter as his daughter is doing them with the various guns. I thought that scene was actually very well done. That was the only one that I really liked, but everything else about that movie was...
That scene actually pissed me off, because there are two times in the movie where... they steal from John Murphy scores, and John Murphy has done work for Danny Boyle. And so one scene, they steal his this song called In the House in a Heartbeat, which is from 28 Days Later. I think it's in the climax of 28 Days Later, and it opens 28 Weeks Later. Mm-hmm. And then the scene that you're mentioning, they have his Adagio in D minor, which he does from Sunshine. And in case you couldn't tell, I think John Murphy's a really good composer. But they make sense in context in the movies they're presented, and seeing them in Kick-Ass is just feels like their power is diluted, because they're just there. And they just sit there while stuff happens, but they don't really augment it other than to make you think, wow, that's cool music. So.
Agree, Jim. So, Kick-Ass. So, Elizabeth, if you're interested in watching a crappy movie, Kick-Ass... Actually, that movie reminded me a lot of it had a lot of the same issues that Watchmen did last year for me, where it was this really well there was a lot of hype behind it, and then a lot of people saw it and they were excited by it and they really liked it, and then I watched it and it's like one of the worst movies ever made, and
that's pretty bad.
I liked Watchmen. But,
how could you like that movie?
In kind of a sort of diluted way, because I was a really big fan of the comic book. And so then when I watched it, even though it wasn't hitting all the notes of the comic, I still thought that it carried enough of that interest and enough of the issues that it tries to bring up. And I think that comparing it to Kick-Ass is... I can understand why you do, but it should show that at least Watchmen has ideas in its head, even if you think that it doesn't execute them well at all.
But it's not even the only reason why it has ideas in its head is because the comic book it's based on is like a well written the whole concept is interesting, but it didn't. Both movies are about superheroes. Both movies are based on comic books. Both movies have that. Both movies even kind of look the same. They all have like that
they
sort
kind
of colorful
kind of candy color
thing, and. I don't know. I actually thought that Watchmen was worse than Kick-Ass, and Kick-Ass was pretty bad. So, but just I've never read the Watchmen comic book, but I can tell you as a non-Watchmen fan and as a fan of movies in general, watching that movie was just one of the worst experiences of my life. And it's 2 hours, two or three hours.
Almost 3 hours.
Watchmen?
Yeah, almost 3 hours.
It is arguably one of the worst.
Halfway through, I started doing because I realized Billy Crudup, or Crudup is the MasterCard guy. And when he narrated it, I was like, priceless. I was not connecting with the movie. I was like, having your own thing on Mars? Priceless. Having a girlfriend who likes your big blue naked self? Priceless.
But that movie had one of the worst scenes I've ever seen in my life. It's the sex scene on the owl ship.
I thought that was supposed to be funny.
Oh,
I did too.
God.
I thought it was supposed to be silly.
I mean, you know, it ends with, like, right when she's about to have her orgasm, she hits the button and then the owl rocket shoots or something. That was so...
That was
I mean,
silly.
I thought that that...
Was that in the comic book?
I don't remember for sure.
Okay.
I think that the comic book, it was like one panel.
Mm-hmm.
Was them, like, getting naked together.
Right.
And that was about all you saw of it. But it's Zack Snyder, so he's going to fetishize that.
Okay. Well.
He
shouldn't have done that.
That's a criticism, I understand, because he kind of fetishizes the sexual side of it more than Alan Moore does. And he also fetishizes the violence more than Alan Moore does, which is really weird, too, because when you think about it, the entire film is about how dangerous it is to have vigilantes.
Mm-hmm.
And yet Snyder kind of lingers on the violence in a way that you don't necessarily see the comic book do too much.
Mm-hmm.
So those are criticisms that I think are valid and are interesting because they also get to the heart of why Watchmen is such a bizarre piece of work is because it's like in the superhero mode, but it's actually, I think it's very much anti-superhero.
Yeah. And they never did explain why Ozymandias had the blue tiger cat thing.
Who? Oh.
they could have taken 2 seconds to just tell me what that thing was.
Oh, this thing,
it was completely distracting in his lair at the end.
Yeah,
that's a pretty cool, what is that thing?
It makes a bit more sense in the comic book because,
yeah,
and there's a brief mention in the film, very brief, and it's very easy
maybe
to miss where
it.
Someone says,
what the hell is that?
No, they're in a restaurant earlier in the film, and you hear someone in the background say, "Oh, I'll have the four-legged chicken, please." And so the implication is that there's some sort of like, there's more genetic manipulation happening in this 1985.
Yeah.
But I mean, they really could have gone a step.
That's so subtle.
And actually explained.
Or not included it.
Because,
whatever.
I mean, even when Alan Moore did it, I thought that was laying it on pretty thick. You might as well have given Ozymandias a little kitten to rub.
That's exactly what I thought.
Oh, nice of you to come to my Antarctic. Because.
Giant cat off my nap.
When you're a villain in a secret lair with a cat, and the argument that you're putting forth as Alan Moore is that maybe there's something to what Ozymandias is doing, you're not helping by putting him in all the cliches of Bond villainry. You know what I mean? So that was.
So why
did
you like the movie though?
I kind of like Snyder's visual style. I think that even though he lingers too much on slow motion, he really does have a good eye for like continuity and action scenes. He really loves his images. And I think that a lot of the actors did a really great job. I loved the idea of Billy Crudup's voice staying normal even as he was Dr. Manhattan. And I thought he did a very good job. And I thought that motion capture stuff with him was just
that was particularly
about as good as like Gollum in Lord of the Rings.
Mm-hmm.
It was impressive, impressive stuff. And I really... And a lot of it was just kind of like a little bit of a pleasure at seeing things that I enjoyed so much in the comic book make it to the screen, even though, like you guys said, I'll admit that they're diluted and sometimes the message is a little conflicted, a little more so than it is in the book. But I think that even though I'll readily concede that it's imperfect, but I just feel like there's so much more happening that in that story, even in movie form, than it is in almost any other superhero story. It's a story that even in movie form still really engages with the idea of like what it means to have superheroes, what kind of people they would be likely to be, which is, you know, outcasts. I mean, like, and psychologically disturbed outcasts and people who basically we shouldn't have the kind of power that they've allocated themselves or has been allocated to them.
Especially displayed by,
comedian.
Yeah. The comedian is kind of the worst example, but also, I mean, like, Rorschach, I mean, he's based on other comic book characters, but I think he's most like Batman in the fact that, like, he's pretty much written himself a license to beat up anyone that he considers to be a sinner, all in the name of some sort of authoritarian code that really just comes about because of past childhood trauma.
Right.
So, I mean, like, I feel like even if it's in film or in comic book form, the more you like kind of try and the more you look at what the characters are like and what they're saying and what they're doing, the more layers there are to it.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, like, and I can totally understand someone not liking it, especially if they haven't had previous experience with the comic book, because it is a fucking weird movie.
Yeah.
And it is not kind to people who don't have that experience. Like you were saying, even something as simple as the cat will have someone who's not an initiate going like,
yeah.
What the hell is that doing here?
So. My favorite part of the movie actually was their opening credit sequence.
Yeah.
That was a great credit sequence.
And that worked for me because it set up the world that I was not familiar with at all because I hadn't read the comic books.
Yes.
So
there's no analog in the comics to that, and he did a great
job. Yeah, so it gave me a lot of the context I needed to get the gist of the movie.
And that credit sequence is interesting, too, because it kind of like, when you're watching, this is so far away from our subject right now.
It's like,
but I just want to make this point really quick, which is that the opening credit sequence pretty much sets up the basic thesis of what Alan Moore was actually saying in the comic book, because when you watch it, you're watching history pretty much unchanged. Despite the fact that all these people are supposedly fighting crime and doing good. In fact, they kind of get pushed into these horrible atrocities. Like you see a decal of Silk Spectre on the side of the Enola Gay right after it bombs Nagasaki. And then you see, the comedian assassinating JFK. And what you're seeing basically is that nothing would be better with superheroes. And in fact, things would probably be worse.
Mm-hmm.
Because all they are, I mean, like, they would either be state-sanctioned, like Comedian is, or they would eventually be cast out and have to, like, do stuff on their own, like Rorschach does. But, I mean, regardless, they're still approaching everything as violence can be a solution.
Yeah, that's very interesting. I think I was a bit too harsh on The Watchmen. What I should have said was there were, even though it was a terrible movie in my opinion, there were aspects of it that I did like. I did like the story, and I did like the acting from the guy who played
Rorschach. Jackie Earle Haley.
Yeah, he was great.
He's a really good actor.
I didn't care for the Batman voice.
I kind of like that though, because it is all fakery.
Yeah.
You know, it's not like, and that's, I mean, again, the comic book explores that better, but like Rorschach at the end is really just a sad, sad individual. He's not a hero at all.
But it's played really well. His scenes are, I thought some of the best scenes in that film, just mm-hmm. because I couldn't quite tell if it's his acting that lifts up all of the scenes up, or if it's just the direction on his scenes was just better than... Also, I really like that scene at the beginning with that really smart guy who's really, really fast, where he sees an assassin coming toward him, and he
mm-hmm.
really quickly, like, he grabs the thing and he whacks him, and
mm-hmm.
I thought that was a really well-shot scene. But what I was talking about before, when I was comparing Watchmen to Kick-Ass, was... Like you were saying before that the story of Kick-Ass, the movie, was terrible compared to the story in Watchmen movie, but
mm-hmm.
you're really giving Zack Snyder too much credit for the film, because the story, the Watchmen story doesn't... Zack Snyder didn't write the Watchmen. He got it from Alan Moore.
Sure,
and the comic book has that story already in place. You know, like, so all Zack Snyder had to do was turn that story into a film, and he did a really bad job of it. Like he turned a good story, like a great comic book story with all these themes that you were talking about, into a terrible film. As opposed to what the guy who did Kick-Ass, I haven't read the Kick-Ass comic books, but that seems like it's a mediocre story that was turned into a mediocre to terrible film. You know what I'm saying? So I think that's why The Watchmen was so disappointing in my eyes. But again, that's just my opinion. I mean,
okay.
Who knows, but anyway, the point is the Watchmen sucked, and Kick-Ass was terrible as well.
That's
so
the most important thing.
So we can agree to that. Very cool. All right, Elizabeth, so you overrated 2010?
Overrated. I'm gonna go animated.
Uh-oh.
And say How to Train Your Dragon.
Oh.
I saw it in the theater, and I had fun in the theater when I saw it, but overall, compared to something like Tangled... or even Toy Story 3, which I didn't hate Toy Story 3, but I didn't love... I like Toy Story, but I don't... Toy Story 3 maybe is a separate issue. Let's just stick with How to Train Your Dragon. I just didn't find the story that compelling and as engaging. And I liked... and the artwork, I didn't love the artwork, I don't think. I feel like at the time I was like, oh, that was really fun, I really liked it, but just... it didn't stick with me as being enjoyable the way Tangled has, which Tangled is a separate, gonna be my next underrated, but spoiler for my underrated. Yeah, How to Train Your Dragon.
Well,
it just wasn't as great as everyone seems to make it out to be, and I didn't think it was that sharp or as funny as other animated films like that have been. And I can't give
Well, the story's pretty traditional. I mean, it didn't really do anything new, for the most part. I mean, it's a pretty average story of a guy, an underdog who...
Yeah. I think that's why
succeeds.
I'm like, it's,
you know,
just kind
there's
of bland.
Been a million films. Have you seen How to Train Your Dragon, Jen?
Nope.
To me, it's kind of bland compared to like a Pixar thing, like Up, or even Toy Story 3, where it's, to me, they're all still unique ideas, and even though maybe the storytelling is relatively conventional, it still gets at deeper things. And I don't feel like How to Train Your Dragon really did that.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking, there was some funny like gags, like, oh, this is our village, isn't it nice? Oh, it's being attacked by dragons, isn't that funny? And it was, and it wasn't, but then, you know, training sequence where you learn how to fight dragons.
It had a training sequence.
You need a montage.
No, I completely agree with you. I was actually bored during How to Train Your Dragon because of those reasons. It's very traditional. I knew exactly where it was going. The only scenes that I liked in that film were the fighting scenes, and that scene near the end with that giant dragon.
Yeah,
they awaken. I thought that was awesome.
The giant dragon was
kind of
cool, and I kind of like the design on the main dragon that the kid tames.
Okay.
But in a way,
I know what you're talking about.
In a way, to me, I just thought of this. It kind of. The turnaround where it's like, let's not fight, let's be friends with the dragons. It's kind of like Monsters, Inc. in a way, where it's like, uh-oh, we're scared of it. Nah, no, it works better by laughter, which when I saw Monsters, Inc., I thought that was sweet, like, the sweetest idea ever. Mm-hmm. I was like, that's so cute.
Original.
And it was original to me, with the idea of monsters making you laugh instead of scaring you, laughter was more powerful than fear. I liked that a lot, and... Now that I think about How to Train Your Dragon, kind of ripped off that. I mean, admittedly, there's a finite amount of storylines in the world, I suppose, so it's not the end of the world. But I just wasn't overall as impressed with How to Train Your Dragon, and I think I'm deeply hurt that it's nominated for an animated Oscar over Tangled.
Oh, really? What, did Tangled just totally get ignored?
They only did three this year.
What?
And I read somewhere there was it's a stupid technicality where not enough animated films or something along those lines came out in time in LA for Tangled to qualify as the best animated feature. I know it wouldn't win against Toy Story 3, and in a lot of ways I like Tangled better than Toy Story 3, but I was like, I just wanted it to even get that little boost, something.
Well, it's
good.
It's probably not going to win, so don't worry about it.
How to Train Your Dragon?
Yeah.
No, I don't expect it to win.
No, I agree with you. I have the same issues. It actually was, I think that How to Train Your Dragon was this year's Kung Fu Panda.
Mm-hmm.
In the sense that a lot of people liked it. It was nice to look at, but it's just, I was just kind of, okay.
And I wanted to like it because I thought how fun that it's dragons and it's Viking, kind of this Viking setting, which isn't as common. And I liked, who was I excited for voice work? I like Craig Ferguson. And
he played the father, didn't he?
No, he was the dragon trainer guy, the one who's training them. And Gerard Butler was the father. And I like
really?
Gerard Butler, but that's just me. I know, it's just me.
These are dragons!
I know. How are you doing, son? I love you! So I was sort of excited for that, but overall it just wasn't terribly impressed with it as a film.
I haven't seen it, so I can't say one way or the other, although I will echo her sentiments about Toy Story 3 maybe not being
greatest thing ever.
You didn't like Toy Story 3?
No, I didn't see that.
Can I piggyback and put Toy Story 3 on this overrated
part?
Because I'm going to go ahead and say Toy Story 3 is a touch overrated.
Ooh.
Yep, it is.
Ouch.
It doesn't really do much that the other two movies didn't do better.
Yeah.
But it added, it closed the story. It wrapped up
did
the story.
Did it close?
I thought the story was pretty well closed at the end of Toy Story 2.
But
Or 1, even.
But...
It
was like Toy Story 2.
I didn't hate it. I didn't I only saw it the one time. I just wasn't... of all those Pixar movies, Toy Story is... The Toy Story ones aren't necessarily my least favorites, but ones that, like... Let's line up the Toy Story one. They're the Pixar films. And Lana Elizabeth, what are you going to gravitate towards? I'm going to go with Finding Nemo and Monsters, Inc. How about Toy Story? Maybe later.
Wow.
Maybe
so some other time. You don't like the Toy Stories?
I don't hate
Toy
them.
Story?
I just don't love them the way a lot of other people do. And I was talking with some of you about this. I didn't have toys like that I was horrifically attached to. Like,
well, that's probably why you don't like Toy Story.
Maybe
then.
That's part of it.
Well, wait a second. She didn't have monsters she was terribly attached to.
I was deeply attached to those monsters.
That's weird.
I mean, I did, but I don't know about her.
That's just bizarre.
I had my own Mike Wazowski. No, I was talking... I didn't have those... And those toys are old, definitely more old-fashioned in a way.
Yeah.
Compared to what kids play with now or don't even play with hardly in some ways. I was just thinking like, oh, I had stuffed animals and things like that as a kid. And we moved out of my house that I grew up in and everything. And I was like, well, come to think of it, if my mom accidentally chucked something in an incinerator, I'm not sure I'd be as emotionally devastated as the movie was hoping I would be.
Well, you know, I normally say that maybe it's because you're a girl that you weren't as attached to your toys. But Jim also agreed with you that Toy Story there wasn't that good.
Why would being a girl make that any different?
Because...
Oh, you know.
Toys are more masculine. You know, when the girls do the makeup and
aren't that masculine.
And the little, like fake, like, cake baking thing.
I never had that.
The pink thing.
I never had an easy bake.
Isn't that a common girl toy thing or whatever?
No, I had...
Barbie's probably the biggest doll in all three movies,
yeah.
And that's a girl's toy.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I mean, how often do girls play with Barbies in the same way that guys play with action figures?
My best friend and I did, yeah. But my best friend and I have a very odd senses of humor to the point where my mom was like, yeah, you two would just cackle in the other room and I wouldn't really know what you were doing, but I'd like listen in from time to time. And it was very odd, very funny. She was like, it was kind of Monty Python in a way because you're just both absurd. Just utterly absurd with what you were coming up with those dolls.
Okay.
Yeah, so, I mean, we had my best friend had a ton more Barbies than I did. I had, like, a handful. And,
Maybe that's what about you, Jim? Did you ever play with toys when you were a kid?
Oh, heck yeah, I had a lot of action figures growing up and things like that. I don't think that that's the problem I had with Toy Story 3. I just felt like I was saying, Toy Story 3 just kind of seemed combined out of elements from the past two Toy Stories,
yeah.
Where the big thing that was happening to one group of toys was that they were being abused by children who didn't know any better, which was the main plot of Toy Story. The first one was Sid, that kid
right.
who didn't. And then the other big one is that Woody's away from everybody and has to, make the decision to go back for them, which is what he went through in Toy Story 2.
Mm-hmm.
So I felt like the film didn't really have any new ground to cover with the characters. I thought that it was fun and it was diverting. I just think I'd put it like, I just don't think that it's, I don't think it was as deep, even though it was weird because too, I mean like you saw it, right?
Yeah.
The ending is kind of famous for causing a lot of people to cry because it's really emotional. But at the same time, there's almost nothing in the film that really leads up to that moment. That's a moment that's kind of in and of itself affecting,
mm-hmm.
but it's
like,
not, but it doesn't feel like a culmination of what's been happening up to then in the film. It feels
mm-hmm.
like something that happens and it, you know, engages you, but I think it engages you in a very basic way that doesn't hinge on these characters. It just hinges on basic humanity.
Yeah,
and,
I don't want to die.
And survival and things like
mm-hmm.
that. So, and that's kind of what's become the most famous. And so, it's funny, there was a bit of controversy because Armand White, that that famous critic that everybody loves, gave the film a negative review.
Wow.
And he was the first one to do so, and like he knocked the film out of its 100% on Rotten Tomatoes thing. And I was thinking, what on earth is making 100% of critics like this movie? Because I mean, certainly I agree it's not a bad movie. And there was stuff in it that I liked, and I thought that some of the jokes were funny. And I thought that actually Michael Keaton playing
yes.
Ken was probably the coolest.
That was my favorite part.
I just loved how he was so much more interested in accessorizing than anything else. So that was good. And
yeah.
So I don't want it to seem like I dislike the movie.
And
I thought it was good.
He's intense in a funny way that made Ken very weird.
Yeah. No, I mean, I thought that was interesting, and that was a nice twist. Oh, and the one other thing that I really liked was when Mr. Potato Head Had to, like, was that a tortilla?
I didn't like that. I found that kind of terrifying.
Hilarious in a Salvador Dali sort of way. His face all on one side of the thing or whatever. I thought that was fun, but I just feel like. And on the other hand, Pixar kind of rescued that from becoming a Disney produced direct to video thing, because Pixar went back, joined up with Disney again, and they took a look at Toy Story 3 and managed to make it into something that was better and that I think is good. But I just don't see why everybody was declaring it to be so great. I think that as far as Pixar goes, Finding Nemo is one I really love. I really love Brad Bird's ones like Ratatouille and The Incredibles. I thought that WALL-E had a lot of great stuff in it. And I thought Up did too, and I think that all those films tried to
Up earned its tears. Let me tell you,
Up did a really good job. Mostly.
It gets weird as it gets into the jungle.
But all those films had more going on with their emotional journeys.
Oh, for sure.
I thought than Toy Story 3, which Toy Story 3 just seemed like a bunch of crap happens, and then things look really bad at the end, and then it's okay, and we're kind of back to where we were. And maybe the problem, too, is that there's no human emotional connection to the toys in the film. You wonder what Andy's going to do with his toys. But, he misses his toys in the first one, as I remember, a little bit more. And they feel a bit more of a connection, too. I don't know. But I guess that one I can't really bolster as much, so I'll leave that argument alone. Mm-hmm. And just say that it's good, it's not great, not really sure why everybody dug it.
In response to the ending as to why, I should disagree. I think that... because it's the third movie, you have to keep the first two movies in mind. And if you do that, the ending of the third, where Andy finally abandons his toys, even though he hasn't really been that prevalent in the third movie, since we know his relationship to his toys in the first two movies, we sort of understand why that moment is so sad. I think that's a justification for that moment.
I wouldn't call it abandoning the toys.
He's giving them away.
But the emotion at the end isn't about Andy. It's about them and each other, about the little toy community they have, because they're all holding hands. That's where the emotion is at the end, I thought.
In the furnace part.
In the furnace
part. No. At the very end, when Andy gives the toys away to that little kid.
Oh, okay, that was cute.
That to me was about Andy, though, too, because Andy had to grow up, and he had to move on from
That scene where they all hold hands is considered a sad scene, really?
Were they about to go
die?
Yeah.
Burn to death?
When they've pretty much accepted the fact and they're...
They're going to melt?
Oh, well, I thought it was going to be obvious that they were going to be saved somehow.
Well, yeah, they milked
that
hell
out.
I was surprised because that's something that you don't see that in animated movies when people accept the fact that they're going to die. You see villains unexpectedly fall, and maybe you see a hero nobly sacrifice himself, but do it in a very quick way.
Yeah,
or something.
And
they usually come back. So you don't see that kind of risk of permanence, of death that you see with that, because
that wasn't tense.
Certainly those films have never indicated that there might be a toy heaven somewhere.
Yeah.
So that's it.
Are atheists.
It's just something they never broached. So it's not like something like Beauty and the Beast where you might be able to hinge on some sort of mystical thing.
Yeah, where it's like, oh crap, the piece got. Oh, he's fine.
Yeah, it's okay. He's in teapot heaven now, which is what they could do in Beauty and the Beast, maybe. But they certainly can't do it in the world they built in Toy Story 3. So that was something that actually I remember reading that affected a lot of people, and I thought, it's affecting in a very basic way, I felt.
Huh.
Also made a lot of kids cry.
It didn't affect me at all. Whoops. I thought it was a cool scene, and I wondered, it went through my mind how they were all going to get out of that, but I never for one second thought that they were all going to die. It's a Disney film. That's a cartoon.
I think there's any doubt among the more among the older members of the audience that they're going to get out of it. I was just really surprised that pushed it as far as they did. Just because, like I was saying, that's something that you don't really get in kids' movies. Death is something very tangible and real, and something that they're actually trying to.
Because being melted down would be from that.
But it's funny, too, because at the same time, that exact plot point was done in The Brave Little Toaster over a decade ago.
Oh, God, yeah.
I've never seen.
Okay. But, no, it's a bunch of machines that are almost about to be destroyed in a junkyard.
Yeah,
interesting.
And they want to get back to their owner.
Sounds
Which is
like
weird, because why would a toaster love a person that
yeah,
much?
Yeah, I mean, like, I guess, yeah, I don't know. That one I'm not sure.
I use a toaster a lot, and my toaster's never been like, I'll miss you.
Yeah, I've never developed an emotional bond except when I'm, like, pissed off because it burned the toast.
Yeah. Maybe the toaster has some sort of... Maybe
I'd be worried if my toaster was following me. It'd probably be, like, trying to strangle me with its electrical cord.
Is it the poor toaster's in an abusive relationship, and, like, the vacuum's like, you have to leave, man. Just let
yeah,
go.
It's a very dangerous codependency between a toaster and a toner.
That movie's also memorable because I think it was like my first introduction to John Lovitz because I think he's the radio.
Yeah, he was the radio.
And I remember liking
and
him a
was
lot
great in that.
And having a lot of fun with that. Anyway.
Cool. And one other thing. Although Toy Story 3 does sort of borrow plot elements from the first two, it also has a unique new story that I thought was really dark for a children's movie. The one with that pink bear,
Lotso.
Yeah.
Lotso. I was gonna.
He was abandoned by his owners in the same way that Stinky Pete was in Toy Story 2.
Yeah.
I mean, if not in the same way, then in a similar way.
Well,
the Jesse, the girl cat.
Jesse.
Oh, you're
Jesse.
Right. You're right. But
that was
the,
actually really heartbreaking when I saw that. I was like,
yeah.
Wow. That's harsh.
But like the psychology behind it was really interesting. The fact that this bear was abandoned and as a result it became bitter and angry and sort of it imposed its hatred onto...
Yeah, no, I mean,
yeah.
Like, he was a pretty good villain.
Yeah.
And that whole society that they built in the kindergarten area or whatever the heck it was. I don't know. I thought that was pretty interesting and complex for a children's movie to have, like, such deep sort of themes. And, you know, I was pretty impressed by it.
No, I agree. I'll agree with that. I thought Lotso was a good character.
Cool. All right.
Good All addition right. to the universe.
Thank you. My overrated guys of the year, There's so many to choose from. All right,
Yeah.
I'm not sure if I talked about this on the podcast before, but True Grit, I thought was really overrated. The first two-thirds of the film are really great. The last third, I'm not sure if I could have sworn. The last third was just awful. It was so bad that it made the rest of the movie just not as good for me. The whole scene...
I'll grant you the abrupt ending, but otherwise, I disagree.
No, it wasn't just the abrupt ending. It was. I'll tell you exactly when the movie started to fall apart. It was the scene when Jeff Bridges' character gets drunk and tells that girl, Haley Steinfeld's character, that he's no longer going to help her. And it just didn't make it, like, why, just because he was drinking, he decides to abandon this mission that he's been on for the last hour and a half?
Which part, like, he does it a couple times, I feel
it's
like.
A scene, no, he does it once. He's in the tent. It's like at the middle of the second act, I think. Or
is it right before she goes to get water?
Yes.
And get
yes.
Okay,
it's that scene where and then she has a whole awkward interaction with Matt Damon's character, where Matt Damon she's trying to talk Matt Damon into staying, and he's like, "No, I'm leaving." And then that scene with the river, where she sees Josh Brolin's character, and
that's amazing. That part.
Awful scene.
I thought that was so good because crazy would it be if you were like, well, this day is not going to start well. Oh my God, it's you.
What are the chances that she just happens to be taking water from the same river that the guy that she's been looking for?
Well, they were tracking him.
But Jeff Bridges, Matt Damon tells her in the scene before that he's giving up as well because they've totally lost them, that there's no way that they're going to find them. And then it just so happens that a few hours later, she stumbles on them by accident.
I didn't mind that.
Well,
I thought that scene was great where she was so determined to kill him.
Well,
like, but she's a baby still. She got his fumbles with a gun and I love that he's like, okay, kid, all right, go for it. You're not going to be able to. You're a baby. You're 14. You're a baby. It's okay. I'll be fine. Oh, my God, you actually shot me.
Yeah.
No, but
it's not a badly
amazing.
Directed movie. The Coen brothers are not bad directors. I thought that the third act suffered from bad writing, that they just didn't adapt it well. The dialogue and also a lot of the scenes, like even those scenes when they kidnap Haley's character and they have that whole interaction where Josh Brolin clearly wants to kill her and she wants to kill him, and the leader of the villainous pack leaves them together tries to justify it by saying, oh yeah, if you kill her you don't get paid. Are you kidding? Like, after the leader of the pack promised Jeff Bridges' character not harm her if you left, it just seemed like
I understood that in the sense that maybe he, I mean, the the leader of the pack, I think he knew what he was doing when he left them alone. I don't know how to.
Yeah, but it's such
that.
A. I don't know.
I got that it feeling where he was like, don't kill her, but if you do while I'm away, it won't be okay, but it probably won't be as bad. There was something about it where I understood. And to me, in a way, it seemed like maybe he didn't give a crap. Obviously, he didn't ultimately give a crap if she died or not. And I don't think he ultimately gave that much of a crap about Josh Brolin either. So I figured if he had, we wouldn't have a movie, but if he killed her before they got back and then he got back. Or even Josh Brolin might take off after he killed her. Who's to say he's compelled to stay at the camp and be like, I killed her while you guys were away getting snacks. Sorry.
My bad.
And I took it that there was sort of a lot of ways that could go that wouldn't end well for either of them, and that's why it was bad in the first place. But then I didn't mind it. I don't know. I was most fed up with, not fed up, I loved the whole movie, and they had the beautiful sequence of going across the plains at night.
I hated that sequence.
It was weird, but I kind of liked it.
I dug the artifice of it.
Yeah.
Such an awkwardly framed scene. Is this an extreme close-up of Jeff Bridges, and he stabs the horse? I mean,
Well, the horse, it was rode.
I know, but it was just
overridden.
Awkward. It was such an awkward, kind of. It was borderline goofy, kind of. I don't know.
Get that vibe. That and
I was
because
kind of
I was so into that part and so like, just waiting, and then boom, I got my arm cut off,
yeah.
And I never saw them again.
The end. Yeah, I know.
That took me out of it. I was so mad.
Yeah,
I hated
that
part. But everything up until then, I really loved.
And also, there's that ridiculous scene when Haley shoots Josh Brolin off that cliff. And the force of the gun propels her back like 20 feet into a cave.
It's more than 20. No, they said there was that.
It's not 20 feet. And also,
whatever.
You see earlier in the film when she shoots at somebody, the kickback knocks her.
Yeah, because guns have big kickback.
Like,
and if you're.
Especially
a kid.
Doesn't she have a shotgun or something?
Yeah,
like
she
that?
Has a bigger gun. And if you're.
I think it's silly that cave just happens to be there so that there can be the obligatory rescue.
It was extremely silly.
I thought that whole cave situation was a contrivance, and I didn't really like it, especially when it was like, oh no, snake.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
I hope that the symbolic poison doesn't fester within her. I thought that was contrived.
There was a payoff to the snake thing, though. That was the payoff, because I had been wondering why he asked to have rope put down on his bed the whole time, and it turns out, I don't know why my mom knows this, but she said snake, or I read this somewhere, she told me snakes don't like going over.
I think they say that in
or
the
maybe
film.
Maybe they say
that
in the
they
movie.
They say in the film, but that's
so
such a, like, that
then to me, there was a payoff to the snake,
but
it wasn't just a random
the,
thing. I don't know.
The thing is, though, I thought that there would be more of a payoff to the fact that he was drinking and leaving those bottles in the trees than the fact that he just had, like, a throwaway line, oh, be careful of the snakes, you know, like, I would think that maybe the drinking would have had. Another really bad scene in the film was the scene when Jeff Bridges and Matt Damon are trying to
shoot each other.
I thought that scene went on for like 5 minutes too long. Like we don't need a whole like section of them arguing and then Jeff Bridges throwing things in the air and shooting, then Matt Damon throwing things in the air and shooting, then back to Jeff Bridges throwing things in the air and shooting. It's like, okay, we get it. They're good marksmen, and Jeff Bridges can shoot even when drunk. We get it. You know, I thought that there would be some kind of payoff to that. The fact that he was a really good marksman while drunk and leaving all these bottles in his trees and stuff, but there wasn't. And then they had a payoff about stupid snakes that they briefly mentioned.
I just thought the bottle in the tree thing was like a way of finding your way back. That's all I thought about it.
Yeah, maybe. But if it
because there clearly weren't like marked trails for them to follow at a certain point, so why not pop the bottle?
If that was
the
case, and then that was something that they could have done to make that ending scene when he's taking her on the horse more interesting, as opposed to
that would have been interesting.
Right.
Couple cutbacks to shots of like, oh, a bottle.
That would have
right.
been interesting.
That
see,
would've
that would have been very creative.
Fair.
But see, the Coen brothers messed up. And also, there's there's the fact that Jeff Bridges is fighting with those men like at least a mile away from the camp. And after Haley's character falls, like, Jeff Bridges somehow knows that she's fallen, and he comes to her rescue, like, 5 minutes later.
Well, I thought Matt Damon told him.
Well,
I mean, you can see down on the cliff, and if Jeff Bridges shoots everybody out, he could probably be like, Brewster, she fell in the cave. I need some help.
I thought that Matt Damon got knocked out, though.
Oh, yeah,
maybe with a rock. And
I don't know. He probably knew where to go.
Rooster has precognition.
Yeah.
I see. Well, that's a little bit.
That also explains why he doesn't need to look for the bottles. There you go. This explains everything.
Or,
psychic powers.
Or
so
he,
right.
Okay, so maybe he didn't know she'd fallen in the cave, but he certainly knew he needed to go up to that bluff and check on her.
Well, yeah, but...
That's true.
That's all he needed.
That probably,
that's all he needed.
Plus, he was trapped underneath the horse. He couldn't move. That in of itself would have taken some time.
Right.
And then he was probably injured from, like, being shot at and trampled by a horse. And he somehow walked all the way up the mountain and found the cave. Whatever. Found the cave that she was falling into, managed to, like, climb down
and rescue
her. Well,
it's pretty hard to miss that cave.
Whatever.
Even though she seemed to forget about it when she had to pull the gun.
She stumbled.
These are all justifications.
She's 14 with a gun covered some
This
flat.
Is bad writing. It's bad, lazy writing. Like, oh, how can we endanger this character?
I don't think it's just fine if I could gather that from the events that happened in the movie.
Whatever. Let's put a cave behind her and let's have her shoot a gun that propels her backward, like, 100 feet. Like, yeah, okay, that's perfect.
Lazy writing. I'm probably not as passionate about it as you, but I agree that the climax isn't as good as
this. It's not a good...
It's just weird to me because True Grit seems so basic for the Coens. You know? I think it's a good story. I think they do a great job of portraying it visually, but it's just like... for some reason, it just doesn't hold the interest to me of something like a No Country for Old Men or The Big Lebowski or Fargo or a lot of their other works, because a lot of their other works seem to have... more going on with their characters and more interesting ways of developing a plot. True Grit, actually, when you get down to it, is like a very beat-by-beat, like, standard kind of Western
movie.
I
wonder if it's because they were sticking to the book, though.
That's probably what it was, and that's not a bad thing, and I think they do a good job of it, but it's just interesting because I feel like they're capable of... I mean, I actually... You know, No Country is kind of a Western in its own way, and I think it's a more interesting one than True Grit is.
Mm-hmm.
So,
mm-hmm.
I mean, like, It's good, but it almost feels to me like the Coen brothers marking time before they make a movie that's more betterer.
More them, maybe.
More them, yeah, I guess.
Yeah, well...
Because a lot of people...
I guess they won an Academy Award.
True Grit,
yeah, I mean, like... I mean, it made a little bit of sense to me because of No Country, but at the same time, I mean, like, when you watch it, it's just like, well, that was a good Western. But it's not anonymous. You can see hints of the Coen brothers in it, but I feel like it has more in common with like recent movies like 310 to Yuma than with their work.
I didn't like 310 to Yuma that much.
Oh, I didn't like 310 to Yuma that much either. But that was also kind of a Western revamp.
Though.
It was kind of predictable in some of its beats, and it wasn't poorly done. But I just
the weak link in that for me was Russell Crowe. To be honest, but
yeah.
I didn't care.
Have you seen the assassination
no.
of Jesse James?
I want to.
That movie's awesome. That movie's one of the best of 2007, actually. That was
there
one.
You go.
There
so,
you
oh,
go.
You know, it was another 2007 one, Into the Wild. I really liked Into the Wild.
I didn't see that.
Really liked it. I thought it was fascinating. It's not... It's,
I disagree.
I thought that character clearly had issues and he was kind of a dumbass.
Oh, yeah.
But I still thought his character was really
interesting.
That's
exactly what my friend said when she read the... She had to read the book for a class and she... And... We wouldn't call ourselves wilderness experts, but she grew up near woods, and as did I. And there's basic. She's like, oh my god, the most basic things he just didn't do. Come on, and she was like to the point of you just couldn't believe.
Yeah.
She's like, I couldn't even believe that really happened to him because he just. Like,
he did everything
just,
except
did everything
learn how to successfully subsist in nature.
Yeah, and learned he did everything the wrong way, and she was like. She's just blown away by it.
Well, at the end of that movie, he's treated like a hero, even though he really wasn't.
She was so mad. She was like, he's a dumbass.
Yeah, exactly.
Who just ate the wrong thing and died in a van.
Yeah, exactly. He did a very, like, cowardly
thing. I have to watch
the
movie again to see if he's portrayed as a hero. I think it's more that he was portrayed as a nice guy who was in over his head.
He's just, no. He's portrayed as heroic, but because he
touched all these people's lives.
That and also he went against like society by doing his own thing and going his own way, paving his own path.
I thought the movie was actually kind of a cautionary tale about not going off half cocked.
Really, I thought it was the opposite.
Well,
I thought it was
punishment
because
is
he's
death by berries.
but at the very end, the letter that he writes at the end of the movie was don't. It's very sympathetic. He wrote like, oh, it's my fault that I'm dying, but. I'm satisfied with that. I lived, or whatever, something like, isn't it like a positive?
Well, it was
like
him coming to
heroic
terms.
Yeah.
Well,
I don't know. I feel like heroic seems to be pushing.
Yeah,
no, but I mean, certainly he considers himself to be heroic in his rejection of society. And also I think that in some ways I can relate to that. I mean, not in the larger side of it, but just in the fact that he kind of, he wasn't as interested in the rat race and he wanted just that brief idea. I don't know if you've ever experienced it, but there's usually at some point in your life you're kind of like, man, I just want to get out of the rat race and fucking live in a cabin in the woods or something like that. I mean, I can totally relate to that desire. And so, like, on that level, like, I understood where he was coming from, but he just seemed to carry it out despite, I mean, like, he just forged ahead and that was the only idea in his mind. I felt like, whoa, buddy, don't forget about, like, antibiotics. You know what I mean?
Food and water.
Yeah, he knows. I mean, I don't know why it's against the rules for him to, like, buy a number of canned goods for the winter. But, you know, I thought that it was, I just thought it was a really interesting story.
I thought 127 hours is similar in that sense that
leave a note.
Tell people where you're gonna go.
I thought
that was the most important. Well, not the most important, but I thought that was definitely an interesting aspect of that, where he was like, he realizes, he's like, wow, if I had told somebody where I was gonna go, or even the general area of where I was gonna be, I might be better off than I am right now.
Right.
You know.
That guy though was prepared. I mean,
but he was more prepared.
Yeah.
He had more experience
in the wild than that other guy. So.
Yeah, and that's what I gathered, was that guy was I think that also proves that just even if you're an expert, which he clearly was to a certain degree, even if you're an expert, just fucking tell somebody where you're going.
Yeah.
But even if you're an expert, it's hard to, things can still happen, you know, out there that you can't control. And I think that was an interesting element to that too, where he was like, whoops, you know, there's not a whole lot I can do now though, you know.
Man.
Except cut my arm off.
Let's take a break.